From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, from the dirt roads of the Depression-era South to Manhattan cabarets, we talk with singer Betty Johnson. When she was a girl, her family sang its way out of poverty with their gospel group, the Johnson Family Singers. As a young woman, Johnson sang jazz standards on TV variety shows and in top nightclubs. After retiring to raise a family, she's performing again. Also today, Eileen Farrell. She's loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. At the age of 75, she's just released what she says is her final recording. And Steven Weinberg reviews To Die For. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava. The peace talks on Bosnia that were to begin in Washington on the 25th of this month have been pushed back a few days. A State Department spokesman says Croatia asked for the change because it was holding national elections on the 25th. With those peace talks in the works, attention is turning to the NATO-led force that would enforce that peace. President Clinton today made clear that he would send troops, even though Republicans in Congress resisted. If the U.S. does not lead, Mr. Clinton said, the job will not be done. In a speech this morning, the president took aim at what he called an isolationist backlash. UPI's Bill Small has more.
Mr. Clinton used part of a speech on foreign policy to warn against attempts by the Republican-controlled Congress to slash spending for a variety of programs related to foreign policy and diplomacy.
Some in Congress literally want to gut foreign assistance, to hack the State Department's budget, to slash the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the USIA, AID. They would shirk our responsibilities to the United Nations.
On that last issue in particular, Mr. Clinton said there are a number of reforms needed at the UN, but that they're no excuse for the U.S. not paying what it owes. The president speaks to the UN General Assembly later this month. Bill Small, Washington.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole this afternoon said President Clinton had not made the case for committing troops to Bosnia. In Paris, another bomb went off today, injuring more than a dozen people. This was the seventh bomb planted in France since July. Earlier in the day, in Lyon, there was a burial for the Islamic radical gunned down by police who suspected him of those earlier bombings. Algerian-born Khaled Kelkal was killed in the village of Maison Blanche last week. The bomb in Paris today went off near a subway station of the same name. New York's Aqueduct Racetrack was the setting today for the second outdoor mass of Pope John Paul's East Coast visit. As he did last night at Giants Stadium, the pontiff called on Americans to remember the poor. He spoke of America's scientific and technological civilization and asked if there were in Queens and in New York room for the mystery of God. Less than a day after Israel's parliament approved the peace plan with the PLO, Israel announced it would release 1,200 Palestinian prisoners in coming days, as outlined in that deal. But Yasser Arafat is charging Israel with committing the first violation of that pact. The self-rule accord called for Israel to release all Palestinian women being held in prison, but Israel says there are four Palestinian women it will not let free because they were convicted of murder. At Boeing plants in Seattle, Portland, and Wichita, union members are walking the picket lines today. In a vote yesterday, 78% rejected a contract offer. Production workers say they're striking over pay, job security, and medical benefits. The Dow Jones is up 3 points at 47.65. This is NPR News. The nation's jobless rate did not budge last month, staying as it has most of the summer at 5.6%. Some economists had been expecting to see a rise in employment in that time. Still, Labor Secretary Robert Reich said he liked the figures.
Unemployment steady as she goes. We are continuing to see a Goldilocks recovery. And not too hot to spur inflation, not too cold to head us back into recession, but continuing just right in terms of job growth.
Reich says 121,000 new jobs were created in September, most of them in service and retail businesses. The governor of Virginia is defending the constitutionality of the state's separate military program for women. That keeps them from attending the state-supported Virginia Military Institute. From member station WVTF in Roanoke, Rick Mattioni reports.
Governor George Allen says he is prepared to defend the state's alternative plan for women who want to attend Virginia Military Institute in Lexington. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to decide whether VMI can legally exclude women, regardless of the separate program at Mary Baldwin College. Governor Allen says VMI must keep women out in order to protect the school's identity.
VMI's done an outstanding job for 150 some odd years, and by allowing women in there, you would certainly change that whole regime.
The Clinton administration contends the only way to guarantee women equal treatment is to admit them to VMI, which is part of the public system of higher education in Virginia. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Mattioni in Roanoke, Virginia.
French soldier for hire Bob Denard, who surrendered in the Comoro Islands yesterday, is being flown to France today. Denard has led several coups in the Comoros over the years, the most recent last week. French troops this week stormed the nation off of Africa's east coast and crushed that coup. I'm Melinda Pencava, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I interviewed singer Betty Johnson, she was a new voice to me. Some of our listeners will remember her from an earlier part of her career when she was a regular on The Jack Parr Show and a headliner at such nightclubs as the Copacabana, the Persian Room, and the Sands. Her music career started as a child when she sang gospel music with her parents and three brothers in a group called the Johnson Family Singers. The North Carolina family sang their way out of poverty, eventually touring the South with stars of the Grand Ole Opry and singing on network radio. Betty Johnson retired from singing to raise her family. Recently, she returned to the New York cabaret scene and to recording. This week, she began a month-long engagement at the Café Pierre in Manhattan. She has two new CDs this month on her own label, Johnson Gray. When we spoke last winter, we opened with a song from her CD, Betty Johnson, A Family Affair.
Baubles, bangles, see how they jing, jing-a-linga. Baubles, bangles, bright shiny beads. Sparkles, spangles, my heart will sing, sing-a-linga. Wearing baubles, bright shiny beads. I'll glitter and gleam so. Make somebody dream so that someday he may buy me a ring, ring-a-linga. I'm told that's where it leads. Sparkles, spangles, my heart will sing.
Betty Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I'm really intrigued by this recording of Bubbles, Bangles, and Beads. I think it's perhaps my favorite recording of the song. I'm not sure. I don't think I usually hear it as a ballad. It's usually done more of an up-tempo or a rhythm song.
That's true. Bubbles and Bangles and Beads is very meaningful to me when I first came to New York and actually was learning to sing popular songs because I had not been singing those with my family for a long time. I met Chet Forrest and Bob Wright. And
the authors of the song.
The authors of the song. And I remember very well saying, oh, I'm going to learn to sing popular songs, and I'm going to have an act, and I'm going to do all these things. And we went to a very tiny club in downtown, I think in the 30s, and about six people were in the audience. Both Bob and Chet were made up the six. And I was going to sing Bobbles and Bangles and Beads. Well, I was extremely nervous. Naturally, my first time in a dark room. I've always been in a studio. And I started singing Bobbles and Bangles and Beads, and I said, Bobbles. And then I thought, I don't remember what I'm supposed to do next. And then I said, Bangles, hear how they jing, jing-a-linga. And then I got more, became encouraged that I really had a voice and it was coming out. And I did it, and after the show, and of course after the song, the six people, including the authors, really loved it. And they said, oh, that's just wonderful. What a wonderful interpretation. And of course, it was just my nerves. And so I kept it in. And now I'm not so nervous when I sing it.
I'd like to go back to your early days when you were singing with your family.
Right.
How did your parents decide to form the Johnson Family Singers?
Well, it's interesting. It's amazing what an empty stomach will do. We were very, very poor people. We lived on a farm. We lived on anybody's farm who would hire six hands. And we were, as little as we were all workers. And it was a very tough life. We didn't know that it was tough because we were a family. We were happy. We had our own cow. We had our own chickens. And we ate well, but we did labor. We were manual laborers. And my dad, we'd come home and we'd sit around on a little braided rug, I remember, in front of the fireplace, and we'd start singing. And we just all had a wonderful talent of singing. So Daddy said, well, you know, I'm going to go to a school. I'm going to go and learn music, and I'm going to teach music. And you're all going to sing, and one day we're going to be a real famous singing family. And we all thought, oh, Daddy's wonderful, but how is this going to happen? Well, on Sunday afternoon, we would all sit on our porch, which was a log cabin, and we announced to different people, you know, the word got around the communities that we were going to sing. And people would come and actually sit on blankets and listen to us sing. And Dad just said, we're going to do it. And he had tremendous vision. I can't believe it, that it all happened. It's such an unbelievable story that most people just don't believe it. That's all.
So did he go to music school?
He went to the Stamps Baxter School of Music in Dallas, Texas. It took a whole year's of earnings of our family to do that. And he was only gone for 4 weeks. And he came back and he had a chart, a music chart, I shall never forget it, a big size like a map, and it had the clefs, and it had the shape notes on it, and he taught us to read that. And we just had that talent.
Well, let's get a sense of what the Johnson Family Singers sounded like. This is one of their recordings.
He put the sunshine in my soul.
First went on the road, I think it was during the Depression, and your father made a trailer that you could travel in. And I haven't seen any descriptions of that trailer, but I just find it hard to fathom that your father would actually make a trailer.
It was like a house trailer, and we bought lumber, we built a chassis, and we left our home in this trailer with a car pulling it, of course, with one envelope that had been given to us by our minister saying, if you ever need money, there is money in this envelope. And my dad said, no, faith is going to get us there, and faith will bring us home. And we would stop. We'd run out of gas, get low on gas. We'd stop at a service station. And my dad say, now, you know, we're a family. We're going to a music school in Cookeville, Tennessee. And we haven't any money, but we have a talent. We will sing for you. You can take up money. You can whatever you want to do. And everybody would say yes.
What would you sing?
Oh, we would sing hymns mostly. And people were just, they loved us. And they saw to it that we got. And by the way, we didn't just sing to exclusive white audiences either. We sang in many, many, many black churches. And wherever, I don't know, you've got to have an awful lot of spunk to do what my dad did.
How would your father get you into black churches? How did he get the people in the black churches interested in your music?
Well,
I should mention here the times are very segregated, obviously, too.
Well, it was very segregated then, of course. It was, I can't tell you how terrible it was. But my dad as a young man had sung, would you believe, in a black, all-black quartet. My dad was a pretty, I can't understand. I know he worked in the mill, and he met some people, some men in the mill that he liked, and they sang. They did barbershop quartet, and then they did spirituals. And actually, that's when my dad met my mother. My dad was singing in a black quartet. Now, you couldn't go in a white church with three black men and one white man, but the black people took Daddy into church.
How did your family end up singing on the radio? I know, I think you sang on radio stations throughout the South.
No, we sang on a 50,000-watt CBS outlet. And the that was...
That'll get you around.
That got us around. But how that happened, there was a big convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it was a contest. And whoever won this contest was to have a shot at a radio program, one guest appearance. My family sang at this contest, and we won. And instead of having just one guest appearance, we were signed for a forever contract. And we started singing a 6:15 a.m. show call. It was a hymn time show every morning. And we drove in from the farm. That was a 45-minute drive. So we just worked all the time and went to school and worked the farm still. But by that time, we bought our own little place. And that was pretty special.
My guest is singer Betty Johnson. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer Betty Johnson. After the family stopped singing together, you went out on your own.
That's right.
And you won the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scouts
contest.
So what opportunities did that open up for you?
That opened up an opportunity of singing. The one thing I could take, the one thing I could do was the Copacabana, which was then a very famous nightclub, and I became the production singer there. And then I got another guest shot on a CBS radio program called The Galen Drake Show, which was a Saturday morning program, and I made the most money I ever made in my life. I made $150 a week. So I was able to move out of the YW and find an apartment down in Greenwich Village. And then I started really pounding the streets and trying to find work. And I walked into a big advertising agency, and I said, I want to meet the top of this agency. Can you believe this? And I met Nat Wolf of Y&R, and he was intrigued that I had the nerve to want to meet him. I had written a letter first, and he was a little intrigued. He said, now, what do you think you can do? And I said, I think I can sell. I said, I want to sell ice cream or milk or toothpaste. And I smiled, and he said, well, you have nice teeth. He said, what would you do if I gave you a glass of milk and told you that it was a Borden milk? And I said, I took the glass, and I took a sip, and I said, that's the best tasting milk this side of Possum Walk Road. He said, where's Possum Walk Road? I said, that's where I come from in North Carolina. That's our farm. Would you believe, Terry, that I got a commercial that lasted for many, many years?
There was a 1958 Billboard review of one of your club acts, and it described you as the girl we all took to the prom. Her good-natured charm, her Wellesley looks, and onstage poise. And I thought, Wellesley looks?
Right.
She grew up in a log cabin. So I bet you felt when you were singing that nobody really knew who you were.
no one ever knew who I was. And I've always felt that nobody's really terribly interested in who you are. They are interested in your entertainment. After all, people are coming to hear you sing. And I would always look the part. Even on the Jack Parr show, I could never talk. He knew me, and he wanted me to talk, but I was unable to talk. And now you can't stop me. You have to be 65. You have to be 65 and know you don't have that many more years to talk, I guess.
I want to play another recording of yours, and you recently reissued recordings that you made, I believe, on the radio.
Yes.
From the Take 5 sessions of the Marine Corps. Was this a radio broadcast for the Marine Corps?
Yes, and it was for the troops, and it was all over the world, and I did it for 4 years.
Oh. And what years were you talking
about? And I loved it. I loved it because it was my daytime work, and I got to sing all the songs I wanted to sing. 1957, 58, 59, 60.
Well, let's hear your recording of that old feeling.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came in sight, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again, I seemed to feel that old yearning. And I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start, for that old feeling is still in my heart.
That's Betty Johnson, recorded in the mid or late 1950s.
Right.
You left singing and retired to raise your family.
Yes.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I had not had a successful... I'd always had a successful career, but I had not had a successful personal life. I was married to my manager of a year. I was divorced. I had been married at 19... I have a beautiful son of that marriage. And I met a wonderful man. I was singing at the Coconut Grove in California, and I met a wonderful person. And I thought, I'm going to have a life after this. I'm not even 30 yet, and I've had two divorces. And what's going on? I'm doing something wrong. So I thought, I have to give up what I love the most. And what do I love the most? I love singing. I love entertaining. I won't tell him this, but I will give this up and devote myself as much as I have to my career. I will devote myself to a husband and hopefully to a family. And I did it. It's the most painful thing I've ever done. And the good news is it paid off. I have a marvelous family. I am very, very proud of my family and of my husband of 35 years.
Well, did he encourage you to give up the thing you love most?
He really didn't know. He didn't know that I was giving it up for the reasons I gave it up. I just said to him, "Oh, I've worked all my life. I don't want to work anymore." You know how a woman will do that. But he certainly has encouraged me to sing now.
What was it like for you during the years when you were raising your children and not singing? Did you sing at home?
No, I never sang at home. I listened to public radio. I listened to classical music all the time. I learned classical music. I went back and got a degree at Dartmouth. I raised a family. I spent time with them. I did everything mothers do. And I loved it. And I'm a gardener, and I'm a master flower show judge. I studied for that. That didn't take me far away from home. So, no, I didn't think about it.
So when did you decide the time was right for you to start singing again?
It took a series of illnesses, major dramatic illnesses.
Yours?
Mine. I had a death experience. I had...
You mean a near-death experience?
Well, yeah, I came back. And then I had a very serious, scary operation on the throat, growth on the vocal cord. I thought after that, God is telling me something. I'm supposed to use this voice that I now have again. And so I just decided to do it. And I called a wonderful piano player, Tony Monti, and I said... I knew he'd be honest with me. Musicians are very honest. They will let you know. And I said, do you think I can do it? And he said, when do we start? So I started rehearsing with him and lost my voice totally. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not supposed to. Then I went away again and came back. And I said, no, I'm going to really try it. And if the people love it, I will do it. And I got an engagement. That was my first engagement with Algonquin. And people did love it, and I realized how much I'd missed it, how much you can give the greatest dinner party in the world, but people do not stand up afterwards and applaud. They just don't do that. They just say, thank you very much. So that was pretty exciting to me, and now I feel that I'm, you know, I'm a minister of music, and I'm putting it out there.
Betty Johnson recorded last February. She's singing this month with her daughter Lydia at the Café Pierre in Manhattan. Her CDs are only available by mail order, so I'll give you the phone number. It's 1-800-838-6110. Johnson has two new CDs this month. My Heart Sings features jazz standards, and In the Garden features gospel duets with her daughter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Out of a dream, you are too wonderful to be what you seem. Could there be eyes like yours? Could there be lips like yours? Could there be smiles like yours, honest and truly? Stepped out of a cloud, I want to take you away, away from the crowd, and have you all to myself, alone and apart, out of a dream.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Eileen Farrell. She's loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. At the age of 75, she's just released a new CD. She says it will be her final recording. Also, film critic Steven Weinberg reviews To Die For. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eileen Farrell has a new CD. She says it's her final recording. She's 75 now and no longer performs. Farrell is generally acknowledged to be the first opera singer to have a hit pop album. That was her 1960 recording, I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues. But more important, she's still considered by many to be the best example of an opera singer who truly understands what to do with American popular song. Farrell is not only unpretentious as a pop singer, she was known for her unpretentiousness in the world of opera. She sang with the Met for 5 seasons and had a long, successful concert career. In 1959, the music critic Winthrop Sargent described her as unquestionably one of the greatest dramatic sopranos alive today. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Eileen Farrell. First, let's hear her sing Just in Time from her new and final album, Love is Letting Go.
Just in time, I found you just in time. Before you came, my time was running low. I was lost, the losing dice were tossed. My bridges all were crossed, nowhere to go. Now you're here, and now I know just where I'm going. No more doubt or fear, I found my way, for love came just in time. You found me just in time and changed my lonely life that lovely day.
Over the past few years, Eileen Farrell recorded a series of albums of American popular song. In 1992, I asked her how she started the series.
Well, let me see. 6 years ago, my husband died, and I just got into a real funk, and I didn't want to sing at all. I was very depressed. And Lunas McGlowan, who, as a matter of fact, Lunas and I had a show on
NPR.
Yes, we did years ago, but we did 12 weeks, and. So Lunas kept saying to me, come on, you got to start singing. I said, no, I don't got to. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do at this time of my life. And he said, no, come on, you've got to sing. So I went down to, Lunas is in North Carolina. So I went down and we started fooling around with the piano and he would pick out a song. I think, oh God, that's so sad. And I'd start to cry and I couldn't sing. So finally, I got a letter from Tam Henderson, who owns Reference Recordings, and just a note saying that he had a small company and he'd been a fan of mine for years and he would like to record me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad. So I said, okay, we'll do one. So he went down to North Carolina and I forget the first one we did. I guess it was probably Harold Arlen because I love him so much. And we started to make these records.
So you said you when you started to sing these songs again, you'd end up crying in the middle of songs.
Oh, honey, I still do.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, because I love sad songs.
Was it always that way, or did that have something to do with your husband's death?
It was always that way. I mean, my husband's death had a great deal to do with it, of course. But, for instance, I could never sing Butterfly. That music in Butterfly just pulverizes me. I just completely go to pieces. And I remember years ago, Eric Leinsdorf said that he wanted me to record the Butterfly with him. And I said, I can't. He said, of course you can. I said, no, I cry. He said, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life. So we went into a studio and he started, you know, playing the Butterfly. And we got to such a spot and all I have to hear is the music. I didn't even open my mouth yet. And the tears started, and he says, oh, you've got to stop that. I said, yeah, it'll be easy for you.
So what happened?
I didn't do it.
Did you ever start crying during a performance on stage?
No. The nearest thing I have, but I have to keep talking to myself all the time. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. While I'm singing, I'm talking to myself. It was the Giancarlo Minotti's To This We've Come. That is pretty, that's a pretty tough message. And I have gotten caught up with that a couple of times. But I got to the point where I said, well, you know, you just can't do this anymore. So, I mean, I can do the aria, but not get carried away by it.
Well, since you've mentioned it, why don't we hear that aria?
Oh, speaking of it.
Speaking of it, this is from Giancarlo Minotti's opera, The Consul. And we'll hear you singing the aria To This We've Come with Thomas Schippers conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Do you remember the making of this recording?
Oh, yes.
Did tears come to your eyes during this?
No, because I tell you, we were in London doing this, and Giancarlo, he came to the recording session. And I was petrified. Here he is sitting there in the studio, and I can see him through the glass, and I'm singing his To This We've Come. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to do this right. And he's listening, and he's so pensive looking. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope it comes out all right. So I was pretty on edge during that recording.
Okay. You're just joining us. My guest is Eileen Farrell. Let's go back to your childhood.
Oh.
Now, your parents had a vaudeville act.
Yes, they did.
It was called the Singing O'Farrells.
That's right.
What was the act?
Well, my mother was a soprano. She, as a matter of fact, she was a coloratura. And I don't think she did that on the stage. I'm not so sure, but she was a soprano. My father was a high baritone. And my father also imitated bird whistles. He could whistle like anything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then my father played most all musical instruments, which they did. So, I mean, this was long before I came along. And but they did the East Coast circuit, and they were, I don't know how many years, but I still have some of their reviews, the Singing O'Farrells.
So did they perform after you were born?
No. My mother was an organist in church. My mother taught piano, and she taught voice. And my father, in order to earn a living for us kids, he was a house painter.
Who got serious about your voice first, your mother or
my
you?
Mother. My mother. Oh, me. Oh, that's the last thing in the world. I mean, I don't know. When I was in high school, I don't know whatever I thought I was going to be, but I had no ambitions to be anything, really. Nothing. Just to have a good time. And when I graduated from high school, my mother said, we used to get the New York Times every Sunday, and there was an ad singing teacher. And my mother knew her because my mother studied with the same teacher that she did. And so she said, we're going to go down and see if she thinks that, you know, you have a voice. We'll go to New York, because we were living in Rhode Island at that time. So we went to New York, and I was more excited to go to New York. That's a great, you know, that was wonderful. I'd never been there before. So I sang for this woman, and she said, yes, she'd take me. So I went back home, and it was in August. No, whenever. September, I guess it was. I went back to New York, and I studied with this woman, and I studied with her about 5 years. She didn't do me any harm, but she didn't correct me very much.
What needed correcting?
I don't know. See, because I found out later that I was her first pupil. Very much later. And she would say, well, now that sounds pretty good. You know, and I said, oh, I guess it's okay. And but she would give me some, you know, vocalizings to do. And I did that. And then I had never learned German before, and I had to learn German. And I was learning sight reading, taking those lessons. And then I had to if I was going to stay in New York, which to me I wasn't going to because I had never been away from home this long. And I told my mother I wasn't going to stay. And my mother said, oh, yes, you are. So I had to have a job in order to stay. So I went to CBS to audition to get into the chorus because that's about all I could, you know, do was sing.
This was CBS Radio.
CBS Radio, yes. This is in 1940.
Mm-hmm. So you auditioned to be in the chorus. You ended up with your own radio show, though.
That's right. I was in the chorus for about 3 months, and then they offered me my own radio show, half-hour radio show once a week, and I was there for 7 years.
So what would you sing on your radio show?
It was a half-hour show. I would do one aria and at least one song in either German, French, or Italian. Then the orchestra would do a couple of numbers, and then I would sing something in English. And so, therefore, it depended upon what the timing of the orchestra and my songs. So I did that because it was just a half-hour show. I did that every week for 7 years.
Did you have a theme?
Yes.
What was it?
It was Let My Song Fill Your Heart.
Uh-huh.
Ernest Charles wrote that years ago. It
was how did that go?
Let my song fill your heart with its melody, oh, so divine. And that's about all they ever heard.
And then an announcer came on.
That's
and said,
right.
Eileen Farrell.
Yeah, right. Here she is. Da, 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 da.
And who was your sponsor?
Oh, it was no sponsor.
No sponsor?
No. Oh, no, 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 no. That was, you know, strictly CBS. In those days, CBS did a tremendous amount of good music because they had the symphony. And they had several shows, I think... One, I forget what one was called. I was on, and several other people had their own shows, and they were not sponsored at all.
Mm-hmm. No, it was around 1940 that you started your radio show.
Right.
It was about 20 years later, in 1960, that you joined the Met.
Yes.
Can you give me a really quick sense of what happened in between?
Oh, from radio, I did concerts all over the place,
right.
Concerts. Then I sang with orchestras, you know, doing arias with orchestra. And I did I did some recordings. And I did quite a few TV things. I did a lot of Gary Moore shows.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of Ed Sullivan shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was, I forget when it was that one day the phone rang and it was Mr. Bing. And he said to me, I've read several times that the reason you are not at the Metropolitan is because you have never been asked. And I said, that's true. I never have been asked. So he says, well, I'm asking you. So that's how that started.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eileen Farrell. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eileen Farrell. You stayed with the Met for 5 seasons.
Yes.
What were the reasons behind your leaving?
Well, the last year I was there, he being Mr. Bing, offered me 2 performances of Chenier. And then he asked me if I would do Wozzeck in English. And I said, no, I wouldn't do Wozzeck in English. I had done it in German. And I had recorded it in German. And I said, I'm not about to relearn an opera. Because I had already done that many years ago with another Strauss opera. Ariadne. And it's very difficult. And I thought, at this stage of the game, I'm not going to start doing that. So when I said no to him, I had a feeling that that's, that was it. So the next season, my manager called him to say, you know, what do you have to offer next year? Because we have to plan concerts around it. And he said, we have nothing to offer her next year unless one of our foreign artists will relinquish a role to her, then she can have it. And I said to him, no thanks. I said to my manager, you say, tell him no thanks and take my name off the roster. So that's just the way it ended.
Were you very sorry?
Yes, I was. I loved singing opera. I loved it. But of course, I was doing so many other things. But today, when I'm not doing all these things, I think the thing I miss most is the opera, because I loved being on stage and I loved singing with other people. It's a wonderful experience.
When you came to opera, having been used to radio and to mm-hmm. concert performance, what was newest to you that was the most challenging to get used to?
Memorizing. At least in radio, you know, I've got the music in front of me. I can't forget a word. I can't forget a note. But memorizing was kind of, it wasn't difficult for me, but I had to know it backwards and forwards, you know, and I used to learn it as a play. I used to speak it. I spoke all my lines before I ever sang them. And so that by the time I got to the music, I didn't have to worry about the words.
Right. So did you do that with jazz songs too? Speak them first?
Naturally. But I know an awful lot of jazz music. I really do.
Yeah.
And if I find something, I always read the words first. Read the words first, because words are the most important thing. Breathing and words are the most important thing in singing. Because mm-hmm. if you can't understand your words, I mean, you're just not getting your message across and nobody knows what you're talking about. You see, and I approach it as I'm talking, not that I'm singing, because I approach singing as I'm talking.
Listen, of all the Ed Sullivan shows that you've done,
yeah.
which one really stands out in your mind?
Oh, God. Well, one night he called me Eileen O'Farrell.
Well, that's your original name, right?
No, that was my original name is Eileen Farrell.
But your parents were the singing O'Farrell.
Yeah, I know. They used the O.
Oh, they just used it. I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Because now I found out that O means the son of. since I've been to Ireland 3 times. Oh, it's such a wonderful place. But anyway, to get back to what?
Sullivan.
Oh, yeah. And then, because, you know, you do it in all one day. You get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you rehearse, and then you have to tape it in the afternoon so he could watch it. And then you do it again at night, and that's live, you know. And so that Sunday is just terrible. So I had rehearsed, and then it came, we taped it for the dress rehearsal. And then after the dress rehearsal, after he heard the tape, he said, I don't like that pop. Because I always used to sing an aria and a pop tune.
Uh-huh.
He said, I don't like that tune. And I thought, well, tough, buddy. You know, it's Sunday. So that meant that they had to get the orchestrations down to the theater. And everybody had gone out to get their dinner before 8 o'clock, see? And I'm just sitting there, and I had to find another song that Ed would approve of. So he approved of one, so we passed out all the music, and then I sang that. And he said, yeah, that'll be okay. So then I, you know, try to get my nerves settled down, and then that night I went out, and he introduced me, and I sang the aria, and then he introduced that I was going to sing such and such a song, and it was the song that he didn't want me to sing.
Yeah, so what'd you do?
At that point, I didn't know what I was going to sing. I hadn't the slightest idea what that song was that we had changed to. I tell you, that was a moment of really, I could have died. Oh, I could have killed him. I could have killed him. So the orchestra started the introduction, and the Lord was with me, because I recognized from the introduction, and I started to sing, and I sang the whole thing. Well, I had five or six shows to do with him, and I canceled the rest of them. I think I cannot go through this. Life is too short. But he was a very funny man, though, you know, and he didn't know it.
It's true. So that was your last Sullivan show?
Yeah, sure was.
Wow.
It sure was. But I did a lot before that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen Farrell, it's been just a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you for asking me.
Eileen Farrell, recorded in 1992. Here's more from her new CD, Love is Letting Go, which she says is her final recording.
I've never been in love before. Now all at once, it's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is wine that's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour. So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in. I've really never been in love before.
This is Fresh Air. In the film To Die For, the director of Drugstore Cowboy, Gus Van Sant, turns a tabloid melodrama into a satire of media-dazed America. Nicole Kidman plays a minor TV personality who gets her teenage lover to kill her husband, played by Matt Dillon. The script is by comic writer Buck Henry, who shows up in a few scenes as a high school teacher. Guest film critic Steve Weinberg has a review.
The black comedy To Die For, about a woman who will stop at nothing to make herself a TV personality, is shallow and obvious. But it pats itself on the back for being cynical about the seductiveness of the media and for taking a jokey, supercilious tone. And it makes the audience feel superior to the characters. My guess is it'll be taken seriously as a satire on America's love affair with celebrity. The writer, Buck Henry, and the director, Gus Van Sant, tell us exactly how to respond. Henry's script spins off the Pamela Smart case. Smart, a New Hampshire schoolteacher, arranged for her teen lover to get rid of her husband. In To Die For, Nicole Kidman plays Suzanne Moretto, a desperately ambitious young woman who talks her way into a clerical job at a local cable station. In her mind, it's the first step on the way to becoming Barbara Walters or Jane Pauley. She gets herself on camera announcing the weather and works overtime assembling a documentary on high school kids. But her husband, Matt Dillon, tries to stand in the way of her career. He wants a family. So she seduces one of the teenage boys in her documentary and gets him to kill the husband.
Mr. Moretto, you're the best thing that ever happened to me.
I can't do this anymore.
What?
I can't go home every night and have him try to touch me. And all the time I'm just thinking about you. About us. And when I push him away, he has his temper.
What do you mean? Does he hurt you? Oh.
There were these women, you know, on the Sally Jesse Raphael show the other day.
And they were all wearing disguises so that their husbands couldn't find them, and they were living in shelters, and I thought I could go and live in one of them.
No, listen to me a minute.
Someplace in another state where no one even knows who I am.
Look, couldn't you just get a divorce? And then...
And then he would get the condo. And he'd get the car.
I could never do anything bad to you. Or ever hurt you. A guy that does that to someone like you doesn't deserve to live. That's the truth, he doesn't deserve to live.
No. I suppose you're right. He doesn't.
Like Michael Ritchie's HBO movie, The Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Cheerleader Murdering Mom, To Die For takes a comic approach to a lurid tabloid story. But Cheerleader Murdering Mom had a loose-screw, deadpan style, and the goofball characters resonated. In To Die For, Van Sant, who made Drugstore Cowboy and My Own Private Idaho, takes a slick, comic strip approach. You read the characters inside and out as soon as the camera picks them up. So the talented cast isn't required to do much. Nicole Kidman shows all her cards in the first 5 minutes. Suzanne's a bimbo whose every instinct, even her sexual drive, is a response to the magnet pull of the TV camera. Matt Dillon is scruffy and likable, but he's stuck playing a dimwit in thrall to his explosively sexy bride. The clever casting of Dan Hedaya, the ulcerated dad in Clueless, and Kurtwood Smith, the martinet pop of Dead Poets Society, as their fathers, doesn't go anywhere. Only Joaquin Phoenix, as the teen who becomes Suzanne's willing slave, gives a performance. He has a soft, bedazzled look, and what comes out of his foggy voice is two steps away from baby talk. To Die For is very competent. It gets its laughs. And the punchline wraps up its point of view in a big red ribbon. This is a deliberately self-conscious movie. We're meant to read its self-reflexiveness as part of the message. But when a movie is all about superficiality, it doesn't help much if style equals content.
Steve Weinberg writes about film for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.